you turn to Matthew 24:1. Then Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and his disciples came to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said to them, "Do you not see all these things? Assuredly I say unto you, not one stone shall be left upon another that shall not be thrown down." Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately, saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" And Jesus answered and said to them, "Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many. And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. And then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. And because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations, and then the end will come. Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, whoever reads, let him understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down or take anything out of his house, and let him who is in the field not go back to get his clothes. But woe to those who are pregnant, and to those who are nursing babies in those days. And pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on the Sabbath, for there will be great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Then if anyone says to you, 'Look, here is Christ,' or 'Look, there,' do not believe it. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. See, I have told you beforehand. Therefore, if they say to you, 'Look, he is in the desert,' do not go out. Or, 'Look, he is in the inner rooms,' do not believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will the coming of the Son of Man be. For wherever the carcass is, there the eagles will be gathered together. Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send his angels with the great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heavens to the other. Now learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, you know that the summer is near. So you also, when you see all these things, know that it is near, at the doors. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away." Title of my sermon this morning is "This Generation." We're going to look at this passage as a supplement to our study on Daniel. So if you haven't been following what we're doing in Daniel, especially chapter 7 and following, which we haven't yet done, you're going to see these dovetail together and on important concepts that will be reflected in that study of Daniel. There are three ways that people usually approach this passage. The first one is, it's already been fulfilled. The second one is, it is yet to be fulfilled sometime in the future. And the third one is, it's a mixture of stuff that has been fulfilled and stuff we're still waiting to be fulfilled. That's basically the three ways that people approach it. However, those who hold this third view, some has, some hasn't, have no firm way to distinguish between what has been fulfilled and what is yet to be fulfilled other than their own gut feeling of what the apocalyptic terms that we find in here mean. It's a gut feeling. Well, what does that mean? The sun not shining and the stars falling. What does that mean? Well, I think it means the sun's not shining and the stars actually falling from heaven. And that hasn't happened yet. Therefore, those pieces are future. And so that's the hermeneutic principle that they use. Their feeling, their perception of history, their perception of what that apocalyptic, those apocalyptic terms mean. They reject the clear language in the time text and make the apocalyptic language the key to understanding the passage. And so then the time text, this generation shall not pass away till all these things are fulfilled. That clear time text is trumped by the stars not shining. Whatever that means, they know what it means. And they trump the time text. But all they're relying upon is their perception of what these picturesque sentences mean. What they will actually look like. What would the stars falling or the sun not giving its light and the moon not... What would that look like? They believe they know. And there's no historical record of the sun actually stopping to give its light and the moon not shining and stars falling. So therefore, it's self-evident and obvious to any logical mind that these things are future. And so the time text is trumped. And so we have to fiddle with the time text in order to make it fit into our presumed interpretation of those difficult passages. And so we're still awaiting fulfillment of many of these things that we have read in this passage in Matthew. And obviously those who put all of it into the future also have a particular perspective of what the described events are going to look like in the future. And so they're waiting for those events to happen. But what the group that's putting it all into the future correctly identifies is the time text speaking about this generation. So they've got to somehow, they know this stuff has to be fulfilled in some generation. And so we've got to try and understand, well, how do we understand this generation? Is it the generation that begins to see the stuff starting to happen is going to be fulfilled in their lifetime? Because they keep themselves, they realize Jesus is talking about this generation. So where does the clock start ticking for that last generation? However, their confidence that they have a correct image in their minds about what the fulfillment of the apocalyptic kind of phrases mean or will look like, they throw many of these passages into the future. I'm going to argue for the position that all these things that Jesus listed up to verse 34 were fulfilled in the first century. If we bring our imagination into subjection to the non-apocalyptic language, that which is, oh, I'm not quite sure what that means. If we bring it into subjection to that, to the key verses that Jesus gave us, then we are forced to search Scripture to help us understand the apocalyptic pictures that appear grotesque or fantastic. That's just too fantastic. Jesus anchored this passage for us in verse 34. And so we need to begin our study at verse 34 because he anchored it for us right there. Jesus said to his disciples, "Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away till all these things take place." Matthew 24:34. Those who debate about the timing of this verse focus upon two words. This generation. That's what the focus is upon. Thus we need to spend some time looking at these two words. But before we do that, I want you to notice how strongly Jesus emphasizes the statement. It was very important, and he didn't want anyone to miss it. Jesus was giving the time text. He was giving the key to the prophecy, and thus he not only underlined the sentence, he put it in bold print, and then he used an orange highlighter. Jesus said, "I say unto you." We use similar phrases when we're explaining something and we're talking. We're hoping the person is listening to us when we're talking. We're not assuming he's not listening to us. We're not assuming that. We're assuming he's listening. And then we get to a point and we say, "Now listen to me." Why? Because I'm about to say something that is critical. Listen carefully. Pay attention. That doesn't mean I was expecting you not to be listening to me up to this point. I'm assuming you were, but please don't miss my next point. This is what Jesus was doing. "I say unto you." But there's another emphasis to further focus our attention upon what he was about to say. "I say unto you truly, assuredly." The one Greek lexicon says this is used to begin a solemn declaration and is only used by Jesus. Truly. To paraphrase, Jesus said, "This is very important, so listen up." The Greek is very powerful in the way it puts it out and the way it can arrange its sentence and put things together to give it a punch. Today some people might use the phrase, "I swear this is the truth." And they usually say that when they get about to say something that their hearers might doubt, might not be expected. That truly, let me tell you this. Because you might not be anticipating what I'm about to say. Then after using this double attention getter, he uses a double negative, which in Greek emphasizes the negative, unlike in English. It strengthens the negative. In order to show the impossibility of something happening or not happening, "Truly I say to you, this generation will never, never pass away until all these things are fulfilled." There's absolutely no chance that this generation will pass away. Then Jesus strengthens this even more by contrasting it with verse 35. His utterance he contrasts with the material universe, which he says will pass away, but my words will by no means ever pass away. He's got his focus on an important point here. He takes time to put such a strong emphasis upon a statement that he was about to make was because his hearers were going to struggle with this teaching. Not only in that generation, since then, they struggle with the teaching. So having seen how important the statement was to Jesus, we now look at the debated phrase, "this generation." It all hangs there. There is a plain meaning for this phrase. Then there are more complicated forced meanings. But it's easy to recognize with these forced meanings that the apocalyptic language is trumping the plain language. Always look for that. Is your apocalyptic understanding trumping the plain language? And so the plain language is manipulated so it comes into line with the human guesses at what that apocalyptic picture ought to look like, is going to look like, should have looked like. They're guesses. People have come up with suggestions that this generation refers to Israel as a nation. So the nation will never pass away until all these things are fulfilled. And so you can keep it going forever. Or a particular kind, this generation refers to a particular kind of people, particularly sinful. This kind of a generation will not pass away until all these things are fulfilled. So once you've got this really bad, bad generation on the earth and Christ is coming and his judgment upon it, then this generation, bad, bad people, are not going to pass away until all are fulfilled. But the clock's got to start ticking at some point. However, Matthew, throughout his gospel, uses the word generation in a consistent way with a plain meaning, namely referring to people who were living at the same time, contemporaries, this generation. We are a generation. Matthew 1:17. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. Matthew 12:39. Jesus said, "A wicked and an adulterous generation seek after a sign." Matthew 17:17. "O faithless and perverse generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I bear with you, O faithless generation?" Who's he talking about there? You see, Matthew connects the word "this" to the generation. This generation. And he does that 6 times in his gospel. The word "this" is a ne'er demonstrative. It's not a "that." It's a "this." This one I'm talking to, not that one I'm talking to, or talking about. And each of these 6 places that he uses the word "this generation," which includes Matthew 24, verse 34, he clearly means the generation that was then living. In Matthew 11:16, Jesus said, "But to what should I liken this generation?" He's announcing there in that context impending judgment coming upon his generation. In Matthew 12:41, Jesus says, "The men of Nineveh will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it, because they repented at the preaching of Jonah, and indeed a greater than Jonah is here." He's announcing impending judgment upon his generation. Matthew 12:42. Jesus, the Queen of the South, will rise up in judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and indeed a greater than Solomon is here. Announcing impending judgment upon his generation. She recognized Solomon, his generation didn't recognize him. Jesus said, Matthew 12:45. Then he goes and takes with him 7 other spirits more wicked than himself, and they enter and dwell there, and the last state of the man is worse than the first. So shall it be with this wicked generation. Announcing impending judgment upon his generation. Matthew 23:36. Assuredly I say unto you, all these things will come upon this generation. Announcing impending judgment upon his generation. That's when Jesus says in Matthew 24, this generation will by no means pass away until all these things take place. The plain and simple meaning is that Jesus was referring to the people who were living when he spoke. His own generation. Again announcing impending judgment coming upon his own generation. So let's put 24 in a broader context. Let's go back. If we go back to chapter 23, we see Jesus' scathing indictment and description of the nation's religious leaders in his day. And toward the end of this, Jesus said that all the servants that he had sent to Judah had been scourged or persecuted or crucified or killed. "You have killed them all that I have sent to you, to this city." And he says, "So that the righteous blood, so that might come upon you all the righteous blood shed on the earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Berechiah, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar." Matthew 23:35. He also said to this generation, to these people he's speaking to, he said, "Fill up the sins of your fathers." You see what they did? In another place, Jesus criticized them. He said, you make these elaborate tombs for the prophets that were murdered by your fathers. In doing so, you recognize that these were great men of God that God had sent to the city. And so you build these great tombs for them, and structures, and sepulchres. And yet, you are going to kill me. Fill up the sins of your fathers. Fill it up, because your sin is going to be far worse than what they did. They killed the prophets. You are killing the Son of God. And then Jesus said, in verse 36 of Matthew 23, assuredly, I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. That's the context. Coming up to chapter 24. He said this to the people. There's no possible way to deny that Jesus was meaning those very people he was speaking to. It was then that Jesus gave his lament over Jerusalem. While teaching in the temple, he said, O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the one who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together, as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. See, your house is left to you desolate. 37 and 38. That's how chapter 23 ends. Chapter 24 continues straight on. The disciples were stunned. Stunned. This temple was magnificent. There's a book on the table over there I brought. You get a chance afterwards. Have a look. There's a couple of pages marked. You just try and get a picture of this temple that he was talking about. Was magnificent, massive, commandingly impressive. As they left the temple, Jesus was leaving it for the last time. When he would come back to this temple, it would be in judgment. His disciples, in trying to get their minds around what they had just heard him say, pointed to the majesty of this building and appeared to be looking for clarification. Surely you couldn't have meant this. You know, your house has left you desolate. No, surely we've misunderstood something here. This majestic building. Surely the desolation couldn't fall upon this structure. R.T. France says, the temple building was one of the architectural wonders of the ancient world. Herod had made an incredible temple. This was not the rebuilt temple after the return from Babylon. Herod dismantled that very carefully and with great sensitivity and rebuilt this next temple, because we know that wasn't a great temple when compared to Solomon's temple. Josephus, the Jewish historian who saw this temple with his own eyes, described its magnificence in The War of the Jews, Book 5 and Chapter 5. He said, the towering walls of pure white marble gave the Temple Mount the appearance of a snow-covered mountain when viewed from a distance. As people were coming from a distance, it looked like, with all the dryness around, it looked like this snow-capped mountain. And then the gold, huge gold plates that hung on its walls, he says, when the sun rose and hit those plates, it was like a furnace of glory, shining, beauty. And R.T. France quotes an ancient saying, and the saying uttered apparently by one rabbi was, he who had never seen the temple in all its splendor had never seen a beautiful building. It was the standard. It was impressive. It was stunningly majestic in its appearance. And so the disciples show him the building in verse 1 of 24. In verse 2, Jesus says to them, do you not see all these things? Pointing at the temple. Assuredly I say unto you, not one stone that you are looking at now is going to be left standing upon another. In 70 AD, the Romans literally flattened the temple. The Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, where the Jews pray today, was not part of the temple in the sense of the structure. It was foundational. It was building up the ground so the temple mount could be flat. That's all that's left there. That huge structure was purely getting the ground even, building a foundation so that the temple could lay on top of that. Josephus, who witnessed the destruction of Jerusalem, he wrote, "Caesar gave orders that they should now demolish the entire city and temple, but should leave as many towers," talking about the towers on the walls, the security towers, "as many towers standing as were of greatest eminence," and he names a few of the towers that he left standing, and also leave standing the wall of the city that was enclosed, which enclosed the city on the west side. Leave that wall standing. This was spared in order to afford a camp for such as were to lie in garrison. So for the Roman army, they wanted some kind of, I suppose, there must be a defense, back defense, and a camp built around that. And the towers were spared in order to demonstrate to posterity what kind of a city it was and how well fortified, which the Roman valor had subdued. But for the rest of the wall, it was so thoroughly laid even with the ground by those that dug it up to the foundation, that there was nothing to make those who came thither believe it had ever been inhabited. This was the end which Jerusalem came to, a city otherwise of great magnificence and of mighty fame among all mankind. That's in the Wars of the Jews, book 7, chapter 1, section 1. That's an eyewitness account of what actually happened. So now Jesus moves from there and went up onto the temple of the Mount of Olives. And his disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be, and when will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age?" They want to know. And this is often called, what follows is often labeled the Olivet Discourse, because Jesus was on the Mount of Olives when he gave it. And you also have an account of it in Mark chapter 13 and Luke chapter 21. In Mark, the disciples said, "Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled?" That's Mark 13:4. In Luke, they said, "Teacher, but when will these things be? And what sign will they be when these things are about to take place?" Luke 21:7. You see, the disciples were struggling because they believed the Messiah had come. Jesus was the Messiah. He was here. He was walking on the earth. He was the Christ. He had repeatedly announced to them, "The kingdom is in your midst. It had arrived." To their minds, the temple in Jerusalem was central to Messiah's reign. Central. His reign over the nations was foundationed in Jerusalem, specifically at the temple. All the nations were to come and worship in that temple. That's what the prophets had said. Prophecies like would have been in their minds Jeremiah's words in Jeremiah 3 verse 17, "At that time Jerusalem shall be called the throne of the Lord, and all the nations shall be gathered to it, to the name of the Lord, to Jerusalem. No more shall they follow the dictates of their own hearts." Micah 4 verse 2 says, "Many nations shall come and say, Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion the law shall go forth, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem." Zechariah 8:22, "Yes, many peoples and strong nations shall come to seek the Lord of hosts in Jerusalem, and to pray before the Lord." So the disciples' question clearly shows their confusion. Their confusion about the meaning of Jerusalem and their confusion about the meaning of the temple. What did the temple mean? What did Jerusalem mean? What did it represent? What is its purpose and function? Jesus had made it very plain early on in his ministry. John chapter 4, when he met the woman at the well, and they started speaking, and she's saying, "Where is the right place to worship?" He said, "Time's coming. There's no right place geographically to worship, but the Lord is looking for those to worship Him in spirit and in truth." He'd also said while teaching that one greater than the temple was in their midst in Matthew 12:6. Greater than this place is already standing before you. And early on, in John chapter 2, verses 19 and 21, he said when speaking about his body, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." That phrase ultimately condemned him. But these verses point to the true temple. What is the meaning of the temple? The physical temple in Jerusalem was only ever meant to serve as a type, as a picture pointing to the reality. The physical temple had only ever been a shadow of something far, far greater. It pictured Jesus Christ, who is the temple. And He sits in His temple that is made out of living stones, according to Peter in 1 Peter 2, verse 5. Paul said to the Corinthians, "Do you not know that you are the temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you?" 1 Corinthians 3:16. And again in 2 Corinthians 6:16, he said, "For you are the temple of the living God, as God said, I will dwell in them and walk among them." Paul told the Ephesians that they were a building, saying, "In whom the whole building fitted together grows into a holy temple in the Lord," Ephesians 2:21. You're all pieces and parts of this temple that are being built together and growing into this majestic structure. Jesus is the true temple and His people are the true temple. This is the same temple that Ezekiel saw. When in captivity in Babylon, with Jerusalem in ruins, before they returned, Ezekiel was taken to Jerusalem and shown this incredible structure. This is the temple he's talking about, the temple of Christ and His people. And Ezekiel saw that in Ezekiel chapter 40 and following. It's the city, it's the New Jerusalem. The same New Jerusalem that John saw coming out of heaven. It's the bride of Christ. It's the Lamb's wife, Revelation 21 tells us. Jesus is the true sacrifice. He is the Lamb of God, John 1:29. He's everything. Can you see? He's everything. He's the sacrifice. He's the temple. He's the high priest. He's everything. And the New Testament shows us that. So he's the Lamb of God. Jesus is the true tabernacle, Hebrews 8 verse 2. And so he came and what did he do? He tabernacled with us, beginning of John's Gospel, 1:14. He is the high priest, Hebrews 2:17, and many, many times Hebrews tells us he is the true high priest. The destruction of the temple should have been absolutely no surprise to his disciples had they been listening to his teaching. No surprise. What on earth do they want a temple for? The reality was standing in their presence. This is the temple. And they're saying, "No, look at the structure." Do you see why that had to be brought down? How superstitious and foolish our minds are. We would be still googling and going at that temple if it was still in standing. We still have so much superstition like Moses' burial place. That's why God hid it. Why? Because He's such a great man. He said, "No, I'm scrapping this thing. Because you won't realize, you won't accept, you won't bow your hearts to it until I show you this is finished." And that's why so much revelation had to be laid out with the Olivet Discourse and other places to explain this is such a massive change in direction in their thinking. Not in God's thinking. This was the plan. This is from the beginning. This is where we're going. All three accounts of the disciples' questions to Jesus in Matthew, Mark, and Luke ask when the judgment that Jesus announced upon the temple would come to pass. It's impossible for them to be referring to anything other than what Jesus just said about the desolation coming upon Jerusalem and his detailed description of the utter destruction of the temple. That's what they thought. When? When is this going to come to pass? What are the signs that are going to show that this is about to happen? He announced the utter destruction of the temple and his disciples pointed to it. They said, Jesus, what about this? He says, absolutely destroyed. And so they ask, when these things would happen. And then in the second part of their question, they wanted to know about the signs that would precede the destruction. But the wording of Mark and Luke is slightly different to Matthew. Mark has, and what will be the sign when all these things will be fulfilled? Luke has, and what sign will they be when all these things are about to take place? And Matthew has, and what will be the sign of your coming? And of the end of the age. Mark and Luke ask what signs would indicate that the judgment was about to be fulfilled, whereas Matthew asks what sign would indicate that Jesus was about to come. It's a prophetic explanation to us. It's giving us an understanding of what they understood. Coming in judgment, signs of this destruction is the same as Jesus coming. Matthew also added a little bit more. What will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? I suggest to you the fact that Mark and Luke didn't add on end of the age means that they lumped that all together. It was all the same. They were merely talking about the same thing. When is this destruction coming? Whether their understanding was correct or not is not the issue. What they understood, this is what they understood. When is this judgment coming? When is Christ coming? So those phrases we can regard as synonyms. Namely, that the judgment being fulfilled. When is this judgment going to be fulfilled? Christ coming and the end of the age. In the disciples' thinking, we're all the same thing. And Jesus then began to answer their question. What are the signs when this is going to happen? What's going to happen? This building is going to be flattened. What are the signs that are we going to look at before that happens? That's what they're wanting to know. And he begins to tell them. And he tells them the signs that would be seen. And he warns them that the prophesied destruction, what would be the things that would take place before it happened. When we pay attention to the whole flow and context, we see that Matthew chapter 23, Jesus announced the religious leaders and told them, he denounced the religious leaders, and he told them that they were going to be judged for all the righteous blood that had been shed, and then he gave them the time text. Assuredly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation. Matthew 23:36. Before this, Jesus had already spoken of impending judgment coming upon his generation at least seven times in Matthew. At least seven times. Matthew 11:16, 12:39, 41, 42, 45. Matthew 16:4, Matthew 17:17. Judgment is coming, people. Kept repeating it. Jesus then lamented over Jerusalem in Matthew 23:37 through 39. Chapter 24 opens with Jesus and his disciples leaving the temple and then pointing to this impressive building, whereupon Jesus said that not one stone would be left standing upon another. Then when Jesus went out onto the Mount of Olives, his disciples come and say, what? Tell us, when is this going to happen? And then Jesus ended by giving another time text, this generation, which throughout Matthew has a simple, plain meaning. The people that were then living. Assuredly I say unto you, this generation will by no means pass till all these things have been fulfilled. We've seen that the flow of the context from chapter 23 through 24:34 is a natural progression showing Christ's conflict with the rebellious people in Jerusalem. It's a conflict. That whole section is a conflict. But we could even go further back and see the same consistent flow. Let's go to chapter 21 where this final, Jesus' final coming to the city begins. And how does that begin? He sends his disciples to fetch what? A donkey. And he's sitting on the donkey. For what purpose? to fulfill a prophecy from Zechariah. His triumphal entry into the city, where they acknowledge him as their king. Behold, Zechariah's word, Zechariah 9, verses 9 and 10. Behold, your king is coming to you lowly and riding on a donkey. His dominion shall be from sea to sea and from the rivers to the ends of the earth. This is the King of Kings. Next, Jesus cleansed the temple. Just follow this from Matthew 21 through to where we're up to, 24. It's a flow. Next, he cleanses the temple. Judgment. He clears up people's thinking with respect to paying taxes to Caesar. He clears up their thinking about the resurrection and then silenced them with a quote from David and asked them whose son Christ was, since David called him Lord. So who is he? Chapter 22, Jesus told the parable of the wedding feast. This was back in 21. He told the parable of the wicked vine dressers and asked them what the owner of the vineyard would do to those wicked people. And they said that he would destroy these wicked men and leave his vineyard to others who would render fruits in its season. He said, indeed. And the religious leaders perceived he was talking about them. Then in chapter 22, I kind of jumped ahead there. Jesus told the parable of the wedding feast, where the people refused the king's invitation to attend. So he burned their city. He exposed their corrupt thinking, as I said, with paying taxes. He silenced them with the resurrection and ended with this. Okay, if David calls him Lord, then whose son is he talking about? Then in chapter 23, he began his extended declaration of judgment upon the scribes and Pharisees, which ended with, assuredly, I say unto you. This is all coming upon this generation. Matthew 21 through 24, 34 describes the confrontation between Jesus and the rebellious people in Jerusalem, and Christ coming upon them in judgment permeates the whole of it. It's all about his judgment upon them. As a final thought, despite the importance, how incredibly important, this understanding about the temple and its destruction and all that is, the Olivet Discourse is not found in the Gospel of John. To me, that's a huge blunder on John's part. Huge blunder. How do you leave that out? This is central to the whole messianic kingdom. It's central to the work of the Messiah. It's central to proving his authority and his dominion and his judgment upon the city, of his position and glory of where he reigns from. It's absolutely critical. And John leaves it out? Did he? He didn't. He dedicated a whole book to it. Book of Revelation is an unpacking, an unfolding, an expanding, and an explanation of the Olivet Discourse. What we'll begin doing next time is looking at the things that Jesus said would happen within a generation from when he spoke. A simple reading of this whole context clearly and easily leads to this understanding. Yet due to a few difficult apocalyptic statements and statements that our minds can't get around, people turn this plain message into a confusing jumble. I hope to show you that there is a way to understand these apocalyptic statements without doing violence to the plain meaning of Jesus' words, that all these things he said would come to pass in that generation he was speaking to. Within their lifetime. Let's bow our hearts. Thank you, Lord, that your word is unchanging, that it is authoritative in every detail. And we do pray, Lord, that you would help us to understand these things, knowing how massively it impacts our thinking and our living in these days. Help us to catch a picture and a glimpse of the glory of your kingdom, of your reign, of your temple, of the majesty of who you are and what you are doing, and of our position in that picture. Help us to understand these things so that our lives might be effective in manifesting the might and the glory and the majesty that alone is in you and flows from you. And so help us to be faithful in making these things known. In Christ's name I do pray. Amen.